Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Sam, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Coping with the Stress of Caregiving When Your Loved One Has Myelofibrosis. And this is part two of a two-part series on living with myelofibrosis. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and a number of other organizations, cancer organizations, including MPN organizations, so the MPN Education Foundation, the MPN Research Foundation, and many other cancer-related organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration and your interest in the topic that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have on the call today over 427 participants, and you come from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada, Korea, the Republic of Korea, Taiwan, and United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world. And it's a credit to you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. Today's program was made possible by the Insight Corporation, CTI Biopharma Corporation, and Baxter International, Inc. And I want to thank them for supporting this entire series, as well as today's program, and for their corporate collaboration in making this program possible. Now, I'd like to turn your attention just for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there are resources and information for you, and there also is an evaluation form. I'm going to ask you all to complete the feedback evaluation form and to return that to us at the end of the call. We very much take to heart your comments and your suggestions and feedback about the programs. Indeed, your feedback has really helped to build the programs and to be sure that we offer programs that are relevant to what you need. We definitely want to offer things that you all need. And so please tell us what you think of the program, even topics that you'd like us to offer going forward. Indeed, this two-part series is one that many of you have asked us to offer, and so we very much try to be responsive to your requests. We're beginning, this is 2015, a new year, and your timing for giving us feedback couldn't be better because we're putting a lot of programs right now, and we'd like to be able to include your suggestions and comments into our planning at this phase and throughout all the phase of the programs. Now, we have wonderful speakers today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Jason Robert Gottlieb, and Dr. Gottlieb is Associate Professor of Medicine, Hematology, Director, Stanford MPN Center, Stanford University School of Medicine, Stanford Cancer Institute. And Dr. Gottlieb is going to address an overview of myelofibrosis, including its current treatments, reducing complications of myelofibrosis, and caring for your loved one with myelofibrosis. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Gottlieb.
Carolyn, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak today, and I'm really excited about the fact that there's so many patients and caregivers on this call. And what I would like to do is start with an overview of myelofibrosis, and then I'll talk about treatments and reducing complications, and also talk about caring for your loved one. To begin with, let me just state that myelofibrosis is an acquired, not an inherited, blood disorder. In myelofibrosis, the marrow makes abnormal blood cells, and in reaction, an inflammatory response occurs, and fibrosis or scar tissue occurs in the bone marrow, and that liquidy pool of blood cells that are made by the bone marrow is replaced by scar. Over time, which can be years, blood counts tend to worsen, and patients can develop progressive anemia or lower red blood cell count and also lowering of the platelet count, which can lead to bruising and bleeding. Now, the body tries to compensate for this lack of production of blood by the bone marrow. In response, the spleen tends to grow in order to try to make blood cells where the bone marrow cannot. Because the spleen is also a filtering organ, it tries to trap the abnormal blood made by the bone marrow, and it also tends to grow for that reason. So myelofibrosis can be associated with fatigue, night sweats, weight loss, and abdominal discomfort from the big spleen. This can be mild for some and more extreme for others. Part of the symptoms is from the disease and associated inflammation. Some is from the big spleen in early fullness because patients have trouble eating from their big spleen. And some from the low blood counts layered on top of all this. And yes, some patients can progress to acute leukemia. Treatment is geared to all of these issues. Now, we have a prognostic scoring system to help assess what stage of the disease a patient is in at the time of diagnosis or over the time of the course of their disease. This uses various clinical and laboratory findings to help stratify patients as relatively lower-risk disease, intermediate-risk disease, or higher-risk disease. And what I mean by risk is the patient's overall survival and the chance of progressing to acute leukemia, which can be more challenging to treat. It also helps us think about what are the most appropriate treatments based on the patient's stage of disease. Treatment is individualized based on the specific patient, and there's not one MF patient and one type of treatment for all. So this really is a good segue to allow me to start discussing some of the available treatments for myelofibrosis patients. First of all, patients with myelofibrosis can be very low risk. And in those patients, they may have minimally low blood counts or very mild symptoms, or the spleen is not enlarged or mildly enlarged. In these patients, a wait-and-watch approach can be undertaken, meaning no specific treatments are recommended. It's just going to the doctor's office perhaps every 3 to 6 months and getting blood counts to see if the disease is changing and at what pace. However, for patients who have anemia that is becoming moderate or severe, supportive treatment options can be undertaken. For example, red blood cell transfusions can be one form of supportive care. The threshold for giving blood transfusions is different for various individuals, but for a patient that has moderate to severe fatigue or their red blood cell count, that is the hemoglobin, is getting lower than 8 to 8.5, red blood cell transfusions could be considered. However, the degree of symptoms and the presence of comorbid conditions such as heart or lung disease may play into the decision to give red blood cell transfusions. Alternatively, red blood cell booster shots such as Procrit could be considered, and responses are on the order of about 20 to 30%. For patients with low platelet counts, particularly below 10,000 or with bleeding, platelet transfusions can also be administered. Now, for the myelofibrosis patient that has a large spleen that is causing substantial symptoms and early fullness, or they're having fatigue or night sweats or weight loss, the standard of care right now is the use of a JAK inhibitor, and the one that is currently FDA approved is a drug called ruxolitinib or Jakafi. And it's worth mentioning that this is a drug that is effective regardless of whether the patients have the JAK2 mutation or not. This is a drug, ruxolitinib, that can provide improvement in the spleen size or symptoms in a significant proportion of patients can do so relatively quickly. It is worth mentioning that correct dosing of the drug is important because anemia, that is lowering of the red blood cell count, or thrombocytopenia, lowering of the platelet count, are real potential side effects of the drug. And so, therefore, dosing of the drug is a major issue that needs to be considered by the doctor and the patient, and the benefits of reducing the spleen size and improving symptoms had to be weighed against the potential for worsening anemia and thrombocytopenia. Now, additionally, another option that is for patients is splenectomy or removal of the spleen by surgery. And I would have to say that this is usually done in patients who have been through most of the treatments, and I suspect that with time, because of the availability of ruxolitinib, which can improve the size of the spleen, that the need for splenectomy may over time decrease. Splenectomy does come with potential risks such as infections or bleeding or clotting in approximately 30% of patients, and it can carry risk of major complications, including death. So this is a decision that's taken very seriously in terms of whether it's needed and what potential benefit it can provide. And then finally, regarding treatments, for patients with higher risk disease, there may be consideration of the role for hematopoietic stem cell transplantation. There are various intensities of types of transplants, that is, how quote-unquote harsh the transplant could be, and a patient needs to work with a doctor to sort out such factors that may play a role in decision-making, such as the patient age, comorbid medical conditions, and of course availability of a suitable donor, such as a matched sibling or an unrelated donor. The prognosis of the myelofibrosis versus potential complications of the transplant are major factors in the decision-making. A referral to a transplant physician is, of course, the first step in this process. So let me move on to another topic of my talk, and that is ways to reduce the complications of myelofibrosis. First, what I would say is that if a patient is in a wait-and-watch mode and they have very low-risk disease, then really the major item that needs to be on the radar screen is just making sure that doctor appointments and lab draws are undertaken as scheduled. Again, a low-risk patient may only need to see a doctor every 3 to 6 months or even less frequently. If a patient is on treatment, then more frequent visits may be needed. And in this regard, if treatment is undertaken, adherence or compliance with the treatment regimen is very important because this can reduce side effects. And it is very important for the patient and caregivers to note side effects and report them as soon as possible so they don't become worse over time. Now, for the patient with myelofibrosis that has a very large spleen, one possible way to reduce the complications or symptoms of the large spleen and abdominal discomfort is to have small frequent meals rather than large meals, and this can really assuage some of the abdominal pain that can be associated with large splenomegaly. Now, for the patient that has the need for blood transfusions or is having bleeding or low platelets, timely lab draws and getting blood or platelet transfusions on time can help reduce extreme fatigue when the hemoglobin goes very low or low platelet-related bleeding. Now, we haven't talked about the fact that there are some patients with myelofibrosis that can have very low white blood cell counts, and those patients may be at an increased risk for infection. So, if a patient with a very low white blood cell count develops a fever or signs or symptoms of an infection such as a cough, new shortness of breath, abdominal pain or diarrhea, or sputum production with a cough, it really is incumbent upon the patient and or their caregiver to have the patient be seen by their physician as soon as possible because sometimes infection can become worse and life-threatening. So early intervention is very key. I should also mention that exercise, of course, is very important, and it's recommended whenever the individual has energy to undertake exercise. We definitely encourage it. My mantra is that MF should not define you, you should define it, and not stay in their house and wait for the disease to progress, even if it happens slowly or potentially over time. Now, lastly, let me just make some comments about caring for your loved one. To me, for the caregiver, this invokes being a helping hand, being an extra ear during a doctor's visit or at home, or the travel in between the two. A loved one can be a diarist for recording symptoms and concerns, can assist with keeping medications in order, can provide emotional support and empathy, can be a spiritual pillar, can be a companion in exercise or other activities, can be an assistant with financial activities that may need extra care and energy. And let me just say, there's just not one recipe for how to be a caregiver for your loved one, and MF patients certainly do need your support. So let me stop there, and I'm very excited to be available for the question and answer period. I'll give it back to you, Carolyn.
Thank you very much, Dr. Gottlieb. That was very comprehensive and excellent. Thank you so much, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Barbara Given. Dr. Given is the University Distinguished Professor, Director of the PhD Program, College of Nursing, Michigan State University. And Dr. Given is going to address what research tells us about caregivers, managing family, friends, partners, and traditions, and self-care and stress management tips. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Given.
Thank you, Carolyn. Thank you, everybody, for being on and being interested in how you can best be supportive at a time when you are, yourself are coping with the stress. And I think the first thing to know is that it is a normal reaction to respond with what we call stress, and that is the overwhelming physical and emotional strain of caregiving. Sometimes it's called caregiver burden, distress or other things, but it is all in response to the demands and the expectations that you just heard from Dr. Gottlieb about all the things that family members can do to support your loved one. And I think it's important to know that you cannot do everything by yourself, and it's important to know that you have to take care of yourself. So if we look at what the research has shown for family and caregivers, We know that they do have stress and distress. We know that those individuals who are most stressed and anxious do often lead to clinical depression, and so it's possible for unmanaged stress to lead to depression. It is likely that the individuals who have stress really have more signs and symptoms from diagnoses that they might have, like arthritis or heart disease or diabetes, and so it actually complicates or adds unmanaged times for those kinds of conditions. So we see that the individuals who have chronic disease often use physicians more and often take more medications than the general population because they are stressed. From the research has also shown that the individuals who are stressed release actually more stress hormones in the body, which then has an overall body effect as well. They spend more time with infectious diseases such as colds and flu and other strep throat and other kinds of infections. Individuals who are stressed from caregiving have a weaker immune response. And therefore, that's the reason why they might get more flu or more infection. There have been some tests out of Ohio State that showed that there's actually slower healing, so that if you get a cut or a bruise or an injury of some sort, that it may take longer for you to get over it. And actually, some cognitive, I talked about depression, anxiety, and, of course, stress is a mental health, but cognitive in that actually concentration and memory and some of those things also go because of the stress that one is under. So there are a number of reasons why it is important for caregivers to try and seek help and information about how to deal with the stress for themselves. So some of the common signs of stress that you need to be alert to is long-term, 2 weeks or more of feeling depressed or more angry than usual or feeling really sad, wanting not to be involved or engaged with others, so actually withdrawing, feeling overwhelmed so that you really find yourself having difficulty getting going or making decisions. Sleeplessness is clearly one of the signs that you might be under distress. Sleeping too much is another way that some people handle it, by just trying to get away with it all. Tension, headaches. Some people have weight alterations. Some caregivers actually gain weight because they're constantly eating or trying to eat comfort food. Others actually have some loss. The detachment from surroundings is something that is noted. And for those who work, sometimes there are difficulties at work. Those are all signs and symptoms that if you notice that or somebody tells you that, you should say, wait a minute. I need to stop a minute and try and come up with some ideas of what I can do to help myself. So some tips and some strategies that might be useful and helpful. I think taking time out, I'm going to say that probably a half a dozen times, taking time for yourself. We have had caregivers in our studies who had a half an hour every day that they went to a room and locked the door and would not answer the phone, that was their private time, some time to get into a yoga state or a mindful state or whatever, but just to get away, sometimes to just take a bath, a hot bath, but that no one could bother them, that was their time. Finding individuals that are going to be support, and I tell everybody there are three kinds of support that caregivers need. One is a family member that they can talk to about everything, who won't try to tell them, don't worry, everything's going to be okay, but really listen. Another is a professional that you can talk to, doctor, nurse, social worker, primary care doc, or maybe oncologist, physician, but one person that you really can tell anything with. And then probably someone who has nothing to do with that. and that would be a friend who's always been a friend or would be a friend. And probably a fourth person would be some family caregiver who's going through the same thing. In one of our studies that was a dementia study, three caregivers of dementia patients would go out and have breakfast once a month, and the only thing they could talk about was jokes and humor. They could not talk about their sad situation, and they really said that that was the most therapeutic, helpful hour a month that they ever had. So finding somebody like that you can talk to and be with. Other times it may be someone who's a minister or someone from the clergy or the church. I think taking time for enough sleep, trying to make sure you have time for sleep, making sure you eat nutritious meals, and watching your diet, if you will. As I said, you don't want to lose weight and you don't want to gain too much weight. So making sure, again, in one of our studies, we found out that the poor eating habits was not the patients who had cancer, malignant disease. It was really the caregivers who used a lot of fast food because that was the way they got through their time and got everything done. I think make a list of all the things that need to be done in the caregiving situation, and you're making that list to sort out two things. One, to sort out for you what it is that has to be done and scratching off the things that you don't have to do. But the more important thing is to ask, pick out of that what others could do for you. Because what we see happen very often is that people ask, what can I do, what can I do, what can I do? And we start saying nothing, nothing, nothing. And then after 4 to 6 weeks or after some period of time, and when there's an acute episode, they stop asking. And that's the time when maybe you would need help. So I always suggest that you make a list of things that others could do and then offer that up. And maybe not everything at once, and maybe not everything to one person, or even thinking about dividing it up. We had someone who rotated months of how she used cousins and nieces and stuff to help her, and that might work. Support groups, and by support groups, it could be actually getting out and attending a support group. But again, for caregivers, sometimes that's depending on the stage of illness, that just takes more time. But please look at all the opportunities in web support groups and phone groups and other ways that you can participate in online kinds of things that might be helpful, and thinking about that. But again, take time for yourself. Take time to pamper yourself. Take time to get away, maybe to go to the library, maybe to go to a drive, maybe to go for a walk. And there's certainly a lot to be said for getting something out of nature, whether it's bird watching or planting or whatever. Do something that really takes away. But remember that if you feel stressed, you probably need to take time and get some help. So if you need financial help, I would talk to the healthcare system about where you might talk to someone. Again, the social workers and the case managers often can help. Are you sure you have enough information? Because a lot of times the stress and the distress that individuals have is because they don't know what to expect, meaning they really lack information. So I think it's important to ask for the information that you need and indicate that. Don't try to be a perfect caregiver. It's not going to be possible to be perfect all the time, and less than perfect is probably appreciated by absolutely everyone because in daily life we're not perfect all the time, and certainly professionals aren't perfect all the time. Identify what you really can change. Identify what you have to change or you believe you have to change. You may not have to do everything that you've always done, whether that be chores or meetings that you always went to or people that you called or whatever. You really don't have to do that all the time. But then don't close it off so you're not getting support from it either. So it's important to stay in touch. Try to find time for physical activity. Whatever that might be, a lot of people like the yoga and like getting away for structured exercises and things like that, because then that really almost forces them to do it because they've joined up to see it. Don't let your own health go away. So make sure you're keeping your primary care appointments. Most of our caregivers would say that you have to maintain a sense of humor, and you have to find out the things that are humorful in each day and look at them and try and make something out of that. I think in tips for asking family members or friends for help, think of things that would help you. Review the list with people and see what they would like to do, or if you know someone that is really particularly good at something, ask them really to do it. Make sure that they understand what would be helpful, and I think set boundaries. So in my own caregiving situation, my brother told everyone what he would do and what they would do and what we would not do for him. And he was very, very clear in that certain things would be bothersome to him because he had a certain organization to what was going to be there, and that's what he wanted. Also, try to make a list of different kind of people who can help you and that you can depend on and that you're willing to share things with. You know, who can help with transportation? Who is somebody you can really cry with? Who's somebody you wouldn't want to tell anything to because it would be spreading? Who would you like to go out with and have lunch with or a cup of coffee? And think about that way so you're actually building your own support system in the way that you want it rather than having other people interfering and barging in. And a lot of people really benefit from some of the email chat rooms or buddies or caring bridges or Post Hope or some of the other kinds of electronic systems, care pages, Post Hope and other things, that because it's a safe way to share some of their feelings and everything. So as I close, those are some of the important things. And again, we can talk in the question and answer period.
Oh, thank you very much, Dr. Given. That was very comprehensive as well, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Ms. Carly Mesovitz. Ms. Mesovitz is an oncology social worker, and she's the caregiver program coordinator at Cancer Care. And she will be addressing coping with holidays, special occasions, anniversaries and birthdays, long-distance caregiving, and Cancer Care's free psychosocial services and programs. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Ms. Mesovitz.
Thank you so much, Dr. Messner. I'm happy to be on this call and listening to my co-presenters and talking to you all today. So most of you just got through a probably very hectic holiday season, so you've had some practice with some of these things and some experiences of your own, but I'm just going to talk a little bit about coping with holidays and other special occasions. So as we all know, the holidays and other special occasions really can represent a time of celebration, getting connected with loved ones, but coping with cancer and caregiving during these experiences can be really stressful. So planning for the events can be overwhelming for anyone. So adding the impact of a loved one's myelofibrosis or other cancer diagnosis can be taxing both for the person who's affected by the diagnosis themselves and also their caregivers. But there are a lot of things that caregivers can do to help themselves and their loved ones maximize these opportunities and really enjoy the celebrations. Paying attention to your loved one's physical and emotional needs, as well as your own, are really essential elements that can help you make the most of special occasions. So some place to start, consider what each specific holiday, occasion, or milestone means to you. What are the most important elements of the celebration? Is it the people? Is it the place? A certain type of food? Is it your culture that impacts that? A certain tradition? Really taking a break to be mindful of the significance of the event can be a helpful starting place in really thinking about how cancer can fit into the picture rather than the other way around. Planning ahead can also be really helpful. Anticipate these occasions before they happen. Consider what you and your loved one can tolerate this year and give yourself flexibility to create a new tradition. managing expectations is a really important part of coping with a loved one's cancer diagnosis. So consider what traditions you might need to take a pass on or mix up a little bit this year. Establishing new holiday traditions with close family and friends might allow both the person with cancer and the caregiver to feel more satisfied and supported during those occasions. And remember, it's okay to say no, to reschedule the celebrations for another time, or it's also just as okay to work to keep a sense of normalcy. Think about what makes the most sense for you and your family, and you get to make up the rules as you go. Some other things to think about during the holidays and other special occasions is your loved one experiencing treatment side effects like fatigue, dietary changes. If so, you might want to invite friends or family over for a potluck so that you can focus on spending time together without all the hard work of cooking and preparing a large meal and all those logistics. Or if you do choose to go out to celebrate, communicate things like dietary needs or special requests to the host. This is a good way of managing the expectation, but also ensuring that you and your loved ones are getting your needs met. It also helps others to support you during those events. And lastly, give yourself a break. So many caregivers put pressure on themselves to be able to do it all. So take some time to really reflect and recognize your efforts. Know that you're doing the very best that you can. And don't hesitate to reach out for support of your own by asking for help when you need it. You can enlist the help of your friends, your family, talk with your loved one's medical team. Sometimes they have really good suggestions, tips, or support to help you through these events. And as we're talking about caregiving, it's also important to remember that caregiving can mean a lot of different things. So caregivers can provide different levels of care, different types of support, and it's a really unique and individualized experience, the experience of caregiving. It's a very individualized role that everyone gets to define for themselves. Something that we're hearing a lot more about these days is long-distance caregiving. So it's important for a caregiver who is providing support from far away to realize that you can still be a really meaningful part of your loved one's experience with cancer and their care, whether you live locally or are caring from a distance. Caregivers who aren't local to their loved ones can provide significant emotional support. Let's not minimize the importance of that. A listening ear, offering a sense of camaraderie and social support for their loved ones, doing that over the phone, via text, email, Skype. Technology is really an advantage to us these days, especially for a long-distance caregiver, and they can help the caregiver to feel connected and in the loop. Staying in touch in these ways helps the patient to feel supported and can help the caregiver feel like they're contributing and being helpful. And again, this layer of emotional support is often just as helpful for many as providing physical care, so do keep this in mind. Caregivers can help coordinate medical appointments, get to know the medical team, advocate for their loved one's needs, both health-related and otherwise, regardless of their physical location. Sometimes it just takes getting a little bit creative. So ask your loved one if they're comfortable having you on speakerphone during a medical appointment, or send them a list of questions that you have to discuss with their doctors, if they give you permission to do that. This can really help you feel involved, gets your questions answered, and reminds the person that you really care and that you want to do everything you can to support them. The other thing that comes with long-distance caregiving oftentimes is a feeling of guilt or a wish that they could do more for their loved ones. So to all you long-distance caregivers out there, remind yourself of all that you're doing rather than focusing only on what you can't do. Give yourself credit for the efforts that you've made and check in with your loved ones to see if they have any suggestions about how you can continue to be helpful to them or what you can do differently. And like my co-presenter spoke of earlier, remember to take care of yourself. Long-distance caregivers really need support too. And so reaching out to a support group or contacting a local social worker really can help you make meaning out of your caregiver experience. Something else that I hear from a lot of my long-distance caregivers that I work with is that it's helpful to have a home team and away team. A home team to be supportive, family, friends, coworkers who are there for you while you're doing the long-distance caregiving, but also creating a network of support for when you do go to make the visit to your loved ones. That's the away team. So they're doctors, a social worker there, a small network of friends that you can talk to. This way, you're not isolated either way. The other thing that I want to talk to you about and just remind you all of is that Cancer Care provides some really great supportive services that are available to the person with cancer and the caregivers throughout the treatment trajectory. Cancer Care provides a number of different supportive services, including things like counseling, support groups over the phone, and also online. So you can be anywhere across the U.S. or even internationally and get connected with our supportive services. We are a staff of licensed master's level oncology social workers, and all of our services are completely free of charge. We're really experienced in helping people to manage the emotional, the physical, and financial challenges that arise after a diagnosis and throughout the caregiver experience. We also offer educational resources like the Connect workshop you're on right now. We can provide information about other resources, ways you might want to navigate the healthcare system, practical help, and sometimes limited financial assistance. While we realize we might not be able to resolve all of your problems that you're facing each day, we will provide a listening ear and the ability to counsel you as you navigate your caregiver experience. And lots of caregivers find this to be a reassuring and comforting service and can help you feel a little bit less alone. So feel free to contact us at 1-800-813-4673 or 1-800-HOPE. To speak with a licensed oncology social worker or log on to our website at www.cancercare.org for more information and support. Just know that we're here. And I'll go ahead and pass things back to Carolyn. Thank you so much for taking the time out.
Oh, thank you so much, Carly. That was really wonderful and actually very creative suggestions for people to think about. And so I think there'll be questions for you also during the Q&A. So now we do have time for questions. We actually have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Sam to bring all of our speakers on board, and we're going to, if you would explain to the audience how to queue up and ask questions, and we'll start. And if for some reason we aren't able to get to your question or think of a question after the program ends, please call us at 1-800-813-HOPE, and I'll repeat that again toward the end of the call as well. Sam?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star, then the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit your questions by clicking on the Ask a Question button. As a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question, please press star, then 1.
And we have there is a question in front of our online participants. So my family members have pressured me into being the primary caregiver for my elderly father who has myelofibrosis. I feel like I am not an adequate caregiver with my other responsibilities and think other family members should play a larger role. How can I help myself and my father? Dr. Given, do you want to start with that question?
Well, it sounds like a situation where probably a family meeting would be in order to really talk about that and to talk about the roles and responsibilities where everybody can be open. And that may mean that you need an outside third party to set in, again, a social worker or a minister or a counselor. Sometimes it would work, or sometimes somebody else from the healthcare team. But to set in and as you talk about that, it's really important that you establish that early in the caregiving, because if a pattern gets set where you are the caregiver and you're carrying all the load, it's going to be hard to give it away and have others do it. Some families decide that if this person has been designated as the primary caregiver, they're going to rotate it, and they will only agree to do it a certain time. And if they do that, then that allows them to get out of it, if you will, and I don't mean that in a negative way, but to be relieved of it, say 2 months later or 3 months later or whatever. It really has to be shared, but so often there's one caregiver, so often it is the daughter and the daughter-in-law, and it's never relieved, even though the situation may go on for years. And that's when the caregiver becomes most stressed and their health suffers from that. So I think a family meeting is a very important thing to have.
Excellent. Thank you. And Carly, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I definitely agree with all that Dr. Given has said. And I think part of being a good caregiver is also recognizing your limits and being able to set boundaries. Sometimes that means delegating certain roles, as Dr. Given mentioned earlier, delegating to people outside of the family, other friends or other people in the community who might be able to help with certain things to make the burden of caregiving a little bit more manageable. You know, think about who's good at what and who can be most helpful with certain things to take some of the load off.
And Dr. Gottlieb, do you want to add anything as well?
No, I think that both were stated beautifully. I think that is a very nice summary, and I agree with everything that was just said.
So we have another question from one of our online participants, actually, about the flu and flu vaccine and then all the other vaccines, both pneumonia vaccine and shingle vaccine. So Dr. Gottlieb, but you could address that question in terms of people interested in getting those shots as well as family members.
Yeah,
in a general way.
Yeah, and generally speaking, I would say that I don't have an issue and encourage the flu vaccine being administered. Regarding the shingles vaccine, that is a live vaccine, and because patients with myelofibrosis are considered to some extent immunocompromised, I generally do not recommend the live shingles vaccine for those patients. I don't have an issue with that vaccine being given to family members. So I think this is something, having said all that, that should be discussed in more detail with the patient's physician and hematologist. But that's my recommendations for those two shots.
In terms of the flu vaccine, are there different types of that where one of them is a live vaccine or not? Or is...
Well, basically, it's they're the ones that are recommended for usually the older individuals, which is primarily the target population of MF, is a killed vaccine, and I would not recommend any other form than the killed vaccine.
Excellent. Okay, thank you. And then there is a question about, can you recommend any diet, exercise, or vitamins that would help me as an exhausted caregiver? Dr. Given, do you want to try that one?
Well, no. Exercise should be something that actually uses major muscles, meaning walking and or swimming or something or other like that. So if there's some place that one can walk safely, walking is always safe, meaning a good thing to do no matter what age and stage, and it also is pretty aerobic and beneficial to individuals, and I think makes one feel good after they've done it. So for those of us here in -7, we would go to the malls and walk or go to a club, but the malls are free to walk. Swimming is something that some of our caregivers indicate they do. Yoga is extremely popular among caregivers to do because it's a defined time and there's usually lots of different times a day and everything one can participate. I think if one looks at the food pyramid and looks at what one needs to have generally to be healthy, that's the best thing to say. And that's really avoiding a lot of the heavy foods and a lot of the saturated fats and also a lot of sugars. And so looking up and just doing the normal healthy food pyramid and looking at what's there. And now there's lots of good things out there and whole grains and everything to have. But a healthy diet for any age is good.
And there is a question about vitamins. So what should we do, Dr. Gottlieb or Dr. Given? Do you want to comment on that? Because
I think I'll let Dr. Gottlieb talk about that.
Yeah, as a purist, there are no studies that indicate particular vitamins are beneficial for myelofibrosis. So what I would say is that if a patient wanted to use a multivitamin, that is fine. I don't have a specific recommendation about are the vitamins being particularly useful or showing advantage. And the only other thing I would say is that there are some patients with myelofibrosis who have needed ongoing need for red blood cell transfusions who may develop iron overload. So if they do have iron overload, I would stay away from supplements that contain extra supplemental iron. And in that regard, if there's a multivitamin, I would then if you are having iron overload, to avoid the multivitamin with iron. And then just getting back to the issue of diet, you know, there are some patients with myelofibrosis who have had issues with progression of their disease and have very large spleens and are consistently losing weight. And so in those circumstances where they're experiencing, you know, 5, 10, 15-pound weight loss over 3 to 6 months, I tend to get less elegant about food choices. Of course, I'm always advocate a healthy, balanced diet, but sometimes it's just about getting calories in to try to avoid excessive weight loss. And in that regard, small, frequent meals and also sometimes supplements such as the Boost or Ensure with or between meals can be useful to try to increase the caloric intake.
And for the exhausted caregiver who actually also, in terms of their recommendations for, you know, for just diet or vitamins or all those kinds of things, your thoughts about that as well? And they would want to speak to their health, to their own health care provider, but just similar recommendations or any particular thoughts about just the general person who might be caregiving for somebody?
I think that would be a unique opportunity for the patient and the caregiver to get a consultation or referral to a dietitian. So, for example, if the patient caregiver are seeing a hematologist who is a primary physician taking care of the case of myelofibrosis, it might be a good opportunity to schedule either before or after that appointment a visit with a dietitian to outline a weekly meal plan to, you know, boost caloric intake or see what a good balance of different food groups is for that particular patient.
Excellent. Thank you. So lots of recommendations here. Really good questions. We have another question from one of our online participants. I feel like I make many mistakes as my mother's caregiver. I blame myself many times for letting things be overlooked. How can I cope with this blame and prevent making mistakes? Ms. Mesovitz, do you want to address this question just in terms of the support groups and that sense of always being feeling guilty or that one has not done all that one could?
Sure. Well, first I would say, of course you're going to make mistakes. Although you're a caregiver, you're still a human, and we all sort of learn by trial and error, and that's certainly a part of the caregiver experience. So I would encourage you to be gentle with yourself as you navigate this role. It's a lot to learn, and again, sometimes we learn that by making mistakes. But I would also say getting connected to other people who can relate to those feelings of just feeling like you've got to do everything right and feeling like you're making mistakes through a support group or individual counseling even, that can be a really powerful experience just to make you feel more capable, more confident in the things that you're doing, but also can normalize the mixed feelings that come with the caregiver role.
Excellent. And Dr. Given, do you want to add anything to that? Or?
No, except I agree. We shouldn't feel guilty for what we do. We should look equally at what we do in a positive way. And again, I think often the support groups can offer suggestions for how they handle it. And I think the only other thing I would say is thinking carefully and planning what you're going to do so that you don't forget stuff. Because I think what caregivers often say is it's not an error of commission, it's an error of omission. They forget to do something, and then they feel really, really bad about that. So sometimes lists will help with that.
Excellent. Thank you. And another online participant writes that I read online that body language is important as a caregiver. Is that true? If so, what are body language do's and don'ts as a caregiver? That's a very rather sophisticated question. I have to say an excellent question. These are really good questions. Ms. Mesovitz, do you want to start with that question and see what you think about this issue of when it's face-to-face and then there may be body language also or sound language also in terms of just phone contact as well, but just the whole issue of body language.
Sure. So when it comes to the basics of communication, we know that body language is important, and you can really show someone how much you care with your body language. So showing up, actually being present when you can, leaning in, offering a hug when somebody is feeling really overwhelmed and needs it, those things can be really important. Showing up to doctor's appointments, keeping eye contact, those things can be really helpful in helping a patient to feel well supported. I'm sure this conversation could go in a lot of different directions because body language is a really sort of subjective thing. So I'd be interested to hear what my sort of co-presenters would say about that.
Dr. Given, do you want to add anything about body language?
One of the things that patients often complain about in their family members is the same thing we complain about with professionals. And that's when you're not at the eye level of the individual, so sitting down to talking to them at eye level, or standing with your 1 foot out the door toward the kitchen or something else if you're a caregiver, or out of the bedroom if a patient happens to be there. So it's actually looking like you're and being attentive to what they're saying with eye contact, and then looking like you have the time and that you're there to listen and that you're full-fledged, that you're not doing iPad or iPhone connections and out the door when you're trying to communicate. Those are really messages that patients pick up as a negative very early.
Yeah, I would agree with that. You know, I make every effort, and certainly my colleagues make every effort to, when we're going into a patient room, particularly when they're admitted to the hospital for any reason, that we just don't stand up at the side of the bed, but we try to sit at eye level, that we're not talking as we're reaching for the doorknob, you know, going out the door, that we're in a clinic visit, that, you know, we have to negotiate looking at the patient and then looking at labs on the computer. And it's not always easy, but we really need to make every effort to show that we're listening and facing the patient and the caregiver. As it relates to the patient and the caregiver, I've certainly had some instances where a patient is sitting next to me and the caregiver right after them, and you ask a question and the patient nods their head yes, and the caregiver nods their head no. And certainly there's sometimes a dissociation between what the patient feels the answer is and what the caregiver feels the answer is. And in those instances, I actually take it upon myself to say, you know, hello, caregiver, I noticed that you were shaking your head differently. Can we talk about this? Because we might be able to understand what the difference is in the particular concern are and come to some idea about where we need to proceed so we can make it better for next time. So this is just one example of body language and how we need to make sure that we authenticate what the issue is by querying both the patient and the caregiver.
That's excellent. Thank you. You're really, this is a, these are great questions, but these are wonderful answers and responses and helpful tips for people to think about. This is really excellent. So we have another question from one of our participants in terms of one of our online participants. The question is, so do you have any suggestions to help me manage my time with my personal needs and my caregiving needs? So Dr. Given, would you like to take that one first?
Well, that's a really tough one, and that's one of the biggest challenges that caregivers talk about, because depending, again, on the stage of the illness, sometimes these are like half-time jobs. So I think when we're talking about managing time, we're talking about someone who maybe is spending 10 hours a day doing caregiving things, or at least attending to caregiving things, and at some phases of illness, even up to the half time. So how do you do that when you have a job and a half or two jobs or whatever? So one has to be very, very organized. And again, I think establishing routines and establishing patterns and trying to establish those and sticking to those are the clearest things that individuals report are there. So like every Tuesday I do this, every Thursday I do this, I don't do things on Tuesday that I don't need to do, and then trying to balance out the day, and always putting in the personal time as an hour a day or whatever the time is that you need as a scheduled time, because otherwise it will get away. Any time that is not on a list or a calendar or a date book or whatever will disappear, and so it is personal time that disappears, and it's leisure time that disappears, and those are essential things to long-term health for the caregiver.
Excellent. And Carly, do you want to add anything? Or
I definitely agree with everything that Dr. Gim has said, and I would say time is not a luxury for most caregivers, and so it's not about adding more time or it's really maximizing the time that you do have. Sometimes something good that a caregiver can do for themselves, again, is to be intentional, as Dr. Gim said. Give yourself, 30 minutes extra in putting yourself to bed. Make sure that you go for a walk every day. Again, it might be walking just around the block once. It might not be a 5-mile walk, but it's something. So making those things intentional, making them a priority is essential.
Now we have just a question that just came in, actually, and it's the question is, how do you handle as a caregiver when the person who has myelofibrosis has anxiety and changing moods? What does the caregiver do when the person they're caring for has lots of anxiety and changing moods? Ms. Methodist, did you want to address that question first anyway?
So it's a really common experience for a patient to be coping with anxiety, fear, mood changes, and it can be really difficult for a caregiver to know how to respond in those situations. So I would say number one is for the caregiver to realize that they can't fix it all. They can't make everything better. But what they can do is sit and listen to the person's concerns, help them get connected with professional support. That's usually a really good starting place to be empathic and offer a listening ear and be supportive, but also to sort of redirect to more professional help, because that can be really important for the patient and can also help give the caregiver a bit of a break.
And Dr. Gibbon, do you want to add anything? Or
not much. I would agree with that, and I think that often caregivers err on the point of not getting help early, and sometimes, somebody says, well, I won't go to a psychiatrist. Well, there are other people who can help. There are counselors, there are social workers, there are nurses, there's clergy, there are sometimes support group visitors, so there are other ways of doing it without labeling someone as mentally ill. But I think people delay getting help, and therefore that makes their job so much harder.
And I would just add that it's important to, of course, always try to drill down on causes. And secondly, sometimes there can be organic or medical contributions to issues of depression or anxiety. So, for example, if the myelofibrosis patient has particularly severe anemia, or they haven't gotten a blood transfusion and their red blood cell count has drifted down and they're yet that much more tired, that can feed into issues of depression and anxiety. So, one needs to just make sure that there are not medical contributions that are exacerbating the underlying anxiety or depression.
That's an excellent point. This is a wonderful, I have to say, I want to thank our speakers. They represent the multidisciplinary team. We have a hematologist-oncologist on the call who specializes in myelofibrosis. We have an expert in caregiving, Dr. Gibbon, and another who's a nurse, an oncology nurse. And we have also Ms. Mesovitz, who is an expert in caregiving and is an oncology social worker. So you have the multidisciplinary team, and you've heard how they all work together to be helpful and to really want you all to be aware of taking advantage of this particular, all of these specialties and other specialties, mentioned dietitians, other specialists, physical therapists, others who could be helpful as well. And they're just such a large array of people. I do want to thank all of you who've been participating today. This has been an extraordinary call, actually. It's wonderful questions, a wonderful team of experts addressing them. I do want to remind everyone that this is an hour education workshop, and that in planning this, we know that you have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. So if we didn't get to your question or you think of another question, please call us at Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE. So again, 1-800-813-HOPE. Please also be aware that all of our services are free, and we provide both practical and financial assistance, as well as a whole array of counseling services and materials and publications that are available for all of you to make use of, as well as these workshops. We have many workshops coming up that might be of interest to you on general topics. And we also, most importantly, don't want anyone to think that you're alone in coping with myelofibrosis, as a caregiver, in coping in general with a cancer or any other type of related concern. We want you to know that you're now part of the cancer care community and that we're here to help you. So please do call us, take advantage of these services, and I want to thank you for your participation, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This does conclude today's workshop. You may all disconnect. Everyone, have a wonderful day.